The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you articles from The Atlantic magazine. And our first article today is entitled Prince Hall, American Revolutionary, and it was written by Danielle Allen. And this article first was published in the March 2021 magazine. Massachusetts abolished enslavement before the Treaty of Paris brought an end to the American Revolution in 1783. The state constitution, adopted in 1780 and drafted by John Adams, follows the Declaration of Independence in proclaiming that, quote, all men are born free and equal, end quote. In this statement, Adams followed not only the Declaration, but also a 1764 pamphlet by Boston lawyer James Otis, who theorized about and popularized the familiar idea of no taxation without representation, and also unequivocally asserted human equality. The colonists, he wrote, are by the law of nature free-born, and indeed all men are, white or black. In 1783, on the basis of the Free and Equal Clause in the 1780 Massachusetts Constitution, the state's Chief Justice, William Cushing, ruled enslavement unconstitutional in a case that one Quack Walker brought against his enslaver, Nathaniel Jennison. Many of us who live in Massachusetts know the basic outlines of this story and the early role the state played in standing against enslavement. But told in this traditional way, the story leaves out another transformative figure, Prince Hall, a free African-American and a contemporary of John Adams. From his formal acquisition of freedom in 1770 until his death in 1807, Hall helped forge an activist black community in Boston while elevating the cause of abolition to the new prominence. Hall was the first American to publicly use the language of the Declaration of Independence for a political purpose other than justifying war against Britain. January of 1777, just 6 months after the promulgation of the Declaration and nearly 3 years before Adams drafted the state constitution, Hall submitted a petition to the Massachusetts legislature, or general court as it is styled, requesting emancipation, invoking the resonant phrases and founding truths of the Declaration itself. Here is what he wrote. The petition of a great number of blacks detained in a state of slavery in the bowels of a free and Christian country humbly should with that your petitioners apprehend that they have in common with all other men a natural and unalienable right to that freedom which the great parent of the universe hath bestowed equally on all mankind, and which they have never forfeited by any compact or agreement whatever. But they were unjustly dragged by the hand of cruel power from their dearest friends, and some of them even torn from the embraces of their tender parents. From a populous, pleasant, and plentiful country, and in violation of the laws of nature and off nations, and in defiance of all the tender feelings of humanity, brought either to be sold like beasts of burden, and like them condemned to slavery for life. In this passage, Hall invokes the core concepts of social contract theory, which grounded the American Revolution, to argue for an extension of the claim to equal rights to those who were enslaved. He acknowledged and adopted the intellectual framework of the new political arrangements, but also pointedly called out the original sin of enslavement itself. Paul's memory was vigorously kept alive by members and archivists of the Masonic Lodge he founded, and his name can be found in historical references. But his life has attracted fresh attention in recent years from scholars and community leaders, both because he deserves to be widely known and celebrated, and because inserting his story into the tale of the country's founding exemplifies the promise of an integrated way of studying and teaching history. It's hard enough to shine new light on an African-American figure who has been long in the shadows, one who in important ways should be considered an American founder. It can prove far more difficult to trace an individual's relationship tree and come to understand that person in a granular and even cinematic way in the full context of his or her own society, family, school, church, civic organizations, commerce, government. Doing so, especially for figures and communities that have been overlooked, gives us a chance to tell the whole story, to weave together multiple perspectives on the events of our political founding into a single, jointed tale. It also provides an opportunity to draw out and emphasize the agency of people who experienced oppression and domination. The case of Prince Hall, the process of historical reconstruction, is still underway. When I was a girl, I used to ask what there was to know about the experience of being enslaved, and was told by kind and well-meaning teachers that, sadly, the lack of records made the question impossible to answer. In fact, the records were there. We just hadn't found them yet. Historical evidence often turns up only when one starts to look for it, and history won't answer questions until one thinks to ask them. John Adams and Prince Hall would have passed each other on the streets of Boston. They almost certainly were aware of each other. Hall was no minor figure, though his early days and family life are shrouded in some mystery. Probably he was born in Boston in 1735, not in England or Barbados, as some have suggested. It is possible that he lived for a period as a free man before he was formally emancipated. He may have been one of the thousands of African Americans who fought in the Continental Army. His son, Primus, certainly was. As a free man, Hall became, for a time, a leather worker, passed through a period of poverty, and then ultimately ran a shop from which he sold, among other things, his own writings advocating for African-American causes. Probably he was not married to every one of the five women in Boston who were married to someone named Prince Hall in the years between 1763 and 1804, but he may have been. Whether he was married to Primus's mother, a woman named Delia, is also unclear. Between 1780 and 1801, the city's tax collectors found their way to some 1,184 different black taxpayers. Prince Hall and his son appear on those tax records for 15 of the 21 years, giving them the longest period of recorded residence in the city of any black person we know about in that era. The DePaul University historian Chernoa M. Sesay Jr.'s excellent dissertation, completed in 2006, provides the most thorough and rigorously analyzed academic review of Hall's biography that is currently available. Hall was a relentless petitioner, undaunted by setbacks. When Hall submitted his 1777 petition, co-signed by seven other free black men, to the Massachusetts legislature, he was building on the efforts of other African Americans in the state to abolish enslavement. In 1773 and 1774, African Americans from Bristol to Worcester counties, as well as Boston and its neighboring towns, put forward six known petitions and likely more to this end. Hall led the formation of the first black Masonic lodge in the Americas and probably in the world. The purpose of forming the lodge was to provide mutual aid and support and to create an infrastructure for advocacy. 14 men joined Hall's lodge almost surely in 1775, and in the years from then on until 1784, records reveal that 51 black men participated in the lodge. Through the lodge's history, one can trace a fascinating story of the life of Boston's free black community in the final decades of the 18th century. Why did Hall choose Freemasonry as one of his life's passions? Alonza Tehuti Evans, a former historian and archivist of the Most Worshipful Prince Hall Grand Lodge of the District of Columbia, took up that question in a 2017 lecture. Hall and his fellow lodge members, he explained, recognized that many of the influential people in Boston and throughout the colonies were deeply involved in Freemasonry. George Washington is a prominent example, and symbolism that resonates with Masonic meaning adorns the $1 bill to this day. Hall saw entrance into Freemasonry as a pathway to securing influence and a network of supporters. In a world without stable passports or identification documents, participation in the order could provide proof of status as a free person. It offered both leverage and legitimacy, as when Prince Hall and members of his lodge in 1786 offered to raise troops to support the Commonwealth in putting down Shay's Rebellion. In the winter and spring of 1788, Hall was leading a charge in Boston against enslavers who made a practice of using deception or other means to kidnap free black people, take them shipboard, and remove them to distant locations, where they would be sold into enslavement. He submitted a petition to the Massachusetts legislature seeking aid, asking legislators to, quote, do us that justice that our present condition requires, end quote, and publicized his petition in newspapers in Virginia, New York, Pennsylvania, and Vermont. In the summer of that year, a newspaper circulated an extract of a letter from a prominent white Bostonian who had assisted Hall on this very matter. The unnamed author of the letter reports that he had been visited by a group of free black men who had been kidnapped in Boston and recently emancipated and returned to the city. They were escorted to his house by Hall, and they told the story of their emancipation. One of the men who had been kidnapped was a member of Hall's Masonic Lodge. Carried off to the Caribbean and put on the auction block, the kidnapped men found that the merchants to whom they were being offered was himself a Mason. Mutual recognition of the shared participation in Freemasonry put an end to the transaction and gave them the chance to recover their freedom. Prince Hall's work on abolition and its enforcement was just the beginning of a lifetime of advocacy. Disillusioned by how hard it was to secure equal rights for free black men and women in Boston, he submitted a petition to the Massachusetts legislature seeking funds to assist him and other free blacks in emigrating to Africa. That same year, he also turned his energies to advocating for resources for public education. Through it all, his Masonic membership proved both instrumental and spiritually valuable. Founding the lodge had not been easy. Although Hall and his fellows were most likely inducted into Freemasonry in 1775, they were never able to secure a formal charter for their lodge from the other lodges in Massachusetts. Prejudice ran strong. Hall and his fellows had in fact probably been inducted by members of an Irish military lodge, planted in Boston with the British Army, who had proved willing to introduce them to the mysteries of the order. Hall's Lodge functioned as an unofficial Masonic society, African Lodge No. 1, but received a formal charter, only after a request was sent to England for a warrant. The granting of a charter by the Grand Lodge of England finally arrived in 1787. By seeking this charter, Hall had written to Masons in England lamenting that lodges in Boston had not permitted him and his fellows a full charter, but had granted a permit only to walk on St. John's Day and bury our dead in form, which we now enjoy. Hall wanted full privileges, not momentary sufferance. In this small detail, though, we gain a window into just how important even the first steps towards Masonic privileges were. In the years before 1783 and full abolition of enslavement in Massachusetts, black people in the state were subjected to intensive surveillance and policing as enslavers sought to keep their human property from slipping away into the world of free blacks. Membership in the Masons was like a hall pass, an opportunity to have a parade as a community to come out and step high without harassment. That's what it meant to walk on St. John's Day, June 24th, and to hold funeral parades for the dead. Whether that stepping out day remained June 24th is unclear. As Sasse writes, Boston blacks, including Prince Hall, first applied to use Faneuil Hall in 1789 to hear an African preacher. On February 25, 1789, the selectmen accepted the application for the blacks to use Faneuil Hall for public worship. By 1820, the walk on St. John's Day appears to have become African Independence Day and was celebrated on July 14th, Bastille Day, much to the displeasure of at least one newspaper. An unattributed column in the New England Galaxy and Masonic magazine complained about the annual parade in recognizably racist tones. This is a day on which, for unaccountable reasons, or for no reason at all, the selectmen of Boston permit the town to be annually distributed by a mob of Negroes. The streets through which this procession passes are a scene of noise and confusion, and always will be as long as the thing is tolerated. Quietness and order can hardly be expected when 500 or 600 Negroes with a band of music, pikes, swords, epaulettes, sashes, cocked hats, and standards are marching through the principal streets. To crown the scene of farce and mummery, a clergyman is mounted in their pulpit to harangue them on the blessings of independence and to hold up for their admiration the characters of Master Wilberforce and Prince Hall. Well after Hall's death, the days for stepping out continued in Boston, an expression of freedom and the claiming of a rightful place in the polity. The lodge that Hall founded continued, too. It is the oldest continuously active African-American association in the U.S., with chapters now spread around the country. Its work in support of public education has endured. In the 20th century, the Prince Hall Freemasons made a significant contribution to the NAACP, in many places hosting the first branches of the organization. In the 1950s alone, the group donated more than $400,000 to the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund. Thurgood Marshall was a member. I have been studying African American history since childhood. When I was in high school, my school didn't do anything to celebrate Black History Month. My father encouraged me to take matters into my own hands and propose to the school that I might curate a weekly exhibit on one of the school's bulletin boards. The school was obliging. It offered me the one available bulletin board. This was not the result of malice, just a lack of attention to the stakes. But I was glad to have access to that bulletin board, and I dutifully filled it with pictures of people like Carter G. Woodson and Mary McLeod Bethune and Thurgood Marshall, with excerpts of from their writings. I am deeply aware of how much historical treasure about Black America is hidden, and I have been actively trying to seek it out. While I was on the faculty of the University of Chicago, I helped found the Black Metropolis Research Consortium, a network of archival organizations in Chicago dedicated to connecting all who seek to document, share, understand, and preserve Black experiences. While I was in Chicago, somewhat in the spirit of that old bulletin board, I curated an exhibit for the Special Collections Department of the campus library on the 45 African Americans who'd earned a doctorate at the university prior to 1940, the largest number of doctorates awarded to African Americans up to that time by any institution in the world. Even so, I had not known about Prince Hall. Having discovered Hall at the ridiculous age of 43, I have since made it a mission to teach others about him. Too much treasure remains buried, living mainly in oral histories, not yet integrated into our full shared history of record. That history can strike home in unexpected ways. Not long ago, I was talking with my father about Prince Hall and the curriculum we were developing. His ears pricked up. Only then did I learn that my grandfather, too, had been a member of the Prince Hall Freemasons. Next, The Key to Critical Self-Awareness by Arthur C. Brooks. Know thyself is the most famous maxim of Greek philosophy, carved into the stone on the Temple of Apollo at Delphi. Why, you might ask? The greatest philosophers and writers throughout history are more likely to tell you why not. So foundational is the idea of self-knowledge to a meaningful existence. In his tragedy, Thyestes, the Stoic philosopher Seneca writes, "Death lies heavily on him who, through all the world well known, is a stranger to himself alone." And as Shakespeare asserts in his comedy As You Like It, "The fool doth think he is wise, but the wise man knows himself to be a fool." Seneca and Shakespeare were artistic geniuses with extraordinary insight, but in an empirical sense, modern behavioral scientists can make an even stronger case for the value of self-knowledge. I'll get to the details of that in a moment, but what their work shows is that knowing thyself can protect people from the damaging errors of biases that lead them into self-serving delusion. What exactly does it mean to know yourself? For neuroscientists, the answer is straightforward enough. Self-knowledge is the combination of two forms of information: direct appraisals and reflected appraisals. The first generally employs the part of the brain associated with the first-person perspective, such as the posterior cingulate. The second with regions associated with emotion and memory, such as the insula, orbital frontal, and temporal cortex. This technical definition of self-knowledge concerns only the mechanisms involved and does not say anything about the quality of the information. In effect, if you think you're a rooster and believe others see you as one too, that counts as self-knowledge. I strongly suspect that the thinkers at Delphi had a bit more in mind than this. They no doubt meant know yourself accurately. This is a much taller order, requiring a huge quantity of truthful information about your interior states, attitudes, beliefs, emotions, traits, motives, over time, in all three of its phases, present, past, and future. Accurate self-knowledge also means avoiding mistakes and correcting illusions, and being completely honest with yourself, possessing a reliable memory, and predicting how you will feel and react in the future. By this impossibly exacting standard, you don't know yourself perfectly, and I don't know myself either. One reason we know ourselves so poorly is that we're prone to major cognitive errors about what we see happening in our lives. Many things in our lives go unnoticed because we lack language for them and don't understand them. This is called hypocognition, meaning a deficit of cognition as opposed to hypercognition. In studies exploring this phenomenon, British participants were more likely to notice cheese than Asian dumplings in their daily lives, while Chinese participants noticed the reverse. A less trivial instance than foodstuffs might involve the way some trauma affects your daily life and who you are, but you are unable to recognize its impact because you have no knowledge about the effects of trauma. Much of our self-knowledge deficit comes from willful ignorance, dishonesty, really, that we indulge to protect our self-esteem. This characteristic rationalizing is almost certainly based on our biology. Neuroscientists have shown that people presented with critical evaluations of themselves display signs of stimulus in the brain's limbic regions associated with their perception. this human capacity to maintain ignorance in the face of potentially negative self-knowledge might make you more comfortable in the short term. To know thyself sounds simple and sensible, but like many other sound injunctions, eat healthy food, treat others with respect, the excellent advice is hard to put into practice because it requires effort. The comfort factor, meanwhile, encourages you to ignore the advice most of the time. So just as dietary protocols may help you overcome a bad snacking habit, a similar set of rules can guide you away from comfort seeking and towards better cognitive health. 1. Stop protecting yourself. Training yourself to accept the regular, systematic physical discomfort of a tough workout in the gym builds strength and endurance. Over time, you will feel much fitter and far more comfortable in your skin than if you'd never left the couch. You can apply the same principle to the work of self-knowledge. Regular, bracing, difficult self-assessment will feel uncomfortable at first, but will make you stronger as a person in the end. Ask your friends and family for honest criticism regularly and insist that they don't hold back. You can call this your emotional workout routine. 2. Embrace a change narrative. If you have a fixed mindset about your strengths and abilities, negative information will surely trip your psychological immune system. Then it will unwittingly deploy whatever tricks it can to disregard the data. However, in a 2008 paper in Personality and Social Psychology Bulletin demonstrated, when people see the potential for growth in their strengths, they are more likely to accept negative feedback and use it to stimulate effort. 3. Decide what to change and get started. It's not enough to believe that positive change is possible. You also need a plan to make it happen, which accurate self-knowledge can facilitate. Some self-improvement goals are straightforward, such as becoming more skilled at your job or a better listener to your partner. But a more fundamental change to who you are as a person is also possible. Realistic, even negative self-knowledge can be extremely liberating even when it does not lead to growth and change. In my late 20s, I finally accepted the reality that I was a good musician, but would never be a truly great one. That left me free to do other interesting and fulfilling things with my life. This brings us back to Delphi and the high priestess Pythia, who was known for her power of prophecy as the oracle. One day a man named Charifion asked the oracle if anyone was wiser than the philosopher Socrates. Pythia replied that none was wiser. This oracular statement got back to Socrates, who instead of basking in the praise, decided to use it to reflect on what would be better self-knowledge, that he was deeply ignorant. This gave rise to the famous Socratic method of seeking knowledge by asking questions while never assuming an oracular authority for oneself that is still used by teachers today. If we seek to follow the Delphic instruction to know thyself, then Socrates shows us the way. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.